In 1880, Lew Wallace published what would become one of the most influential novels of all time. This tale of revenge and redemption captivated readers across America and later the world, selling over 50 million copies and inspiring multiple film adaptations, including the 1959 classic starring Charlton Heston that won a record-breaking 11 Academy Awards. What began as Wallace's spiritual journey after a conversation with renowned agnostic Robert Ingersoll evolved into a sweeping narrative that intertwines the life of a fictional Jewish prince with the historical figure of Jesus Christ. The novel's cultural impact has been so profound that President Garfield appointed Wallace as U.S. Minister to the Ottoman Empire after reading it, and it remained the best-selling American novel until Gone with the Wind appeared in 1936. The story opens during the reign of Emperor Augustus Caesar, when Roman dominion extended from Britain to Egypt, from Spain to Syria. In the modest town of Bethlehem in Judea, a carpenter named Joseph and his young wife Mary arrive, having traveled over 90 miles from Nazareth in compliance with Augustus's imperial decree for a census. The timing proves challenging. Mary is heavily pregnant, and the town is overcrowded with others who have come to be counted. After numerous rejections, they find shelter in a limestone cave used as a stable, where animals provide what warmth they can against the cold Judean night. That same evening, in the pastoral hills surrounding Bethlehem, shepherds maintain their nightly vigil over their flocks. Suddenly, the dark sky erupts with divine light as angels appear, announcing the birth of humanity's Savior. These simple men, accustomed to the quiet solitude of nighttime shepherding, become the first witnesses to history's pivotal moment. Following an unusually brilliant star that hangs low in the eastern sky, they make their way to the stable where they find the infant Jesus lying in a feeding trough, wrapped in swaddling clothes. Meanwhile, far to the east, three distinguished scholars, known as the Magi, have been tracking this same celestial phenomenon. Melchior, a sage from India versed in ancient prophecies, Gaspar, a Greek astronomer and philosopher, and Balthasar, an Egyptian scholar of ancient texts, undertake a months-long journey following the star. Their arrival in Jerusalem creates a stir, particularly when they inquire about the newborn king of the Jews. King Herod, a paranoid ruler known for eliminating potential rivals, including members of his own family, feigns interest while privately plotting destruction. The wise men present their carefully chosen gifts, gold symbolizing kingship, frankincense representing deity, and myrrh foreshadowing sacrifice. Warned in dreams of Herod's true intentions, they return to their lands by different routes. The narrative then advances 20 years to introduce Judah Ben-Hur, a prominent Jewish prince whose family has long been influential in Jerusalem. The political atmosphere has deteriorated significantly under Roman occupation, with increased taxation, military presence, and cultural suppression fueling Jewish resistance. Religious zealots whisper of prophecies and coming deliverance, while Roman authorities respond with increasingly harsh measures. Into this powder keg returns Messala, Ben-Hur's childhood friend, now a tribune thoroughly transformed by his years in Rome. Where once they shared brotherly affection, their reunion reveals an unbridgeable divide. Messala embraces Rome's imperial destiny, while Ben-Hur remains devoted to his Jewish heritage and faith. What begins as a joyful reunion between Ben-Hur and Messala quickly sours as their fundamental differences emerge. Messala, transformed by his years in Rome, returns with an air of imperial superiority that immediately creates tension. His military bearing and richly decorated uniform stand in stark contrast to Ben-Hur's simple yet dignified Jewish garments. Their initial embrace, warm with memories of childhood friendship, gives way to increasingly strained conversation as Messala speaks condescendingly of Jewish customs and beliefs, viewing his former friend's people as inferior subjects meant to serve the empire's greater glory. Ben-Hur defends his heritage with quiet dignity, carefully choosing his words while struggling to reconcile this changed version of his friend with the boy he once knew. The conversation reveals an unbridgeable gap between them, one shaped by Rome's imperial ambitions and deeply held cultural beliefs. When Messala jokingly suggests making Ben-Hur high priest when he eventually rules Judea, the casual arrogance of the statement crystallizes their irreconcilable positions. The Jewish youth realizes their friendship cannot survive such fundamental differences in values, particularly Messala's dismissal of Jewish autonomy and religious freedom. He leaves without accepting Messala's outstretched hand, a symbolic gesture that foreshadows the bitter rivalry to come. The next day brings catastrophe during the arrival of the new Roman governor. While watching the procession from his rooftop with his sister Tirza, Ben-Hur accidentally dislodges a loose tile that strikes the newly appointed Valerius Gratus, throwing him from his horse. The governor's injuries, though not fatal, provide Messala with a perfect opportunity to prove his loyalty to Rome. Despite knowing the true accidental nature of the incident, Messala immediately orders the arrest of the entire Hur household, betraying not only his childhood friend, but also the sacred bonds of hospitality that once united their families. Roman soldiers storm the palatial Hur residence with unprecedented brutality. They arrest Judah, his mother Ruth, and his sister Tirza, showing no mercy despite their high social standing. Their faithful servant Amra is locked inside the sealed house, while the family's vast property, including their merchant fleet, lands, and personal treasures, is swiftly confiscated for the emperor's treasury. The speed and efficiency of their downfall reveal the precarious position of even the most prominent Jewish families under Roman rule. Ben-Hur's life transforms overnight from privileged nobility to condemned criminal. Without trial or opportunity to defend himself, he is sentenced to serve as a galley slave, a virtual death sentence of unimaginable brutality. As he is marched in chains toward the coast, exhausted and dehydrated under the scorching sun, a pivotal moment occurs at a well in Nazareth. A young carpenter approaches and, without speaking, gives the prisoner water despite the Roman guard's threatening objections. Looking into this stranger's compassionate eyes, Ben-Hur experiences a moment of profound peace amidst his suffering. Though brief, this encounter with Jesus of Nazareth plants a seed that will ultimately transform his understanding of justice and purpose, suggesting that true power lies not in imperial might, but in acts of mercy and compassion. For 3 years, Ben-Hur endures the living hell of the Roman galleys, chained to an oar and forced to row in conditions that break most men within months. The galley slaves work in shifts of 6 hours, their backs scarred by whips, their hands calloused and bleeding from the endless rowing. Through this ordeal, Ben-Hur's survival depends on two powerful forces: his burning desire for revenge against Messala and his unwavering faith that his mother and sister might still live. Unlike his fellow slaves who succumb to despair, he maintains a dignified bearing that catches the attention of Roman commander Quintus Aureus, who recognizes something extraordinary in this Jewish slave's demeanor. When Aureus questions him about his circumstances, Ben-Hur's responses reveal both his noble heritage and his steadfast claim of innocence. The commander, known for his shrewd judgment of character, is particularly struck by Ben-Hur's refusal to embrace bitterness despite his unjust imprisonment. In a rare act of trust, Aureus orders Ben-Hur's chains removed before a major naval battle, a decision that will alter both their destinies. The battle against pirates proves catastrophic when their vessel is rammed and splintered. Both men are thrown into the Mediterranean's churning waters. Despite having every reason to flee and leave his former captor to drown, Ben-Hur makes the moral choice to save Aureus. Through the long night, he supports the injured commander in the water, fighting exhaustion and rough seas until Roman rescue ships finally spot them at dawn. This act of mercy from a man who had every justification to hate Romans profoundly affects Arius, leading him to adopt Ben-Hur as his son upon their return to Rome. Under Arius's patronage, Ben-Hur receives a comprehensive Roman education, studying philosophy under Stoic masters, military strategy from veteran commanders, and athletics with particular emphasis on chariot racing, a skill that will prove crucial to his future. He learns to navigate Roman politics and society, accumulating wealth and influence while steadfastly maintaining his Jewish identity. Throughout his rise in Roman society, he never abandons his quest to uncover his family's fate. 5 years pass before Ben-Hur returns to the East, now a Roman citizen of considerable means and influence. In Antioch, he hears rumors of Simonides, his father's former servant, who has become a prominent merchant despite severe physical disabilities. Hoping for news of his family, Ben-Hur visits the crippled businessman and meets his daughter Esther, whose beauty and gentle spirit immediately capture his attention. Though Simonides initially receives him with caution, having learned harsh lessons about trust, he eventually reveals an extraordinary truth. He has been secretly managing the Hur family fortune all these years, expanding it through shrewd trading ventures while awaiting the rightful heir's return. His loyalty proved unshakable, even when Roman authorities twice tortured him, breaking his body but not his spirit, as he protected his master's wealth. This faithfulness was sustained by his deep loyalty to the Hur family and his fervent hope that someday a Hur would return to reclaim their legacy. Fate soon brings Ben-Hur face to face with Messala once more. At Antioch's famous chariot racing track, he witnesses his former friend, now a celebrated charioteer, nearly causing an accident with his reckless driving. When Messala almost crashes into a camel carrying the wise man Balthasar and his daughter Iris, Ben-Hur intervenes, displaying his remarkable strength by stopping the horses. This incident leads to his meeting with Sheik Ilderim, an Arab horse breeder desperate to defeat the Romans in the upcoming races. Recognizing an opportunity for both vengeance and justice, Ben-Hur agrees to drive Ilderim's magnificent Arabian horses against Messala. He trains rigorously, mastering the team, while Simonides arranges extraordinary wagers against Messala, forcing the arrogant Roman to bet 6 times the standard amount. The entire city buzzes with anticipation as race day approaches, with tensions between Jews and Romans reaching a fever pitch. The race itself unfolds as a masterpiece of strategy and skill. For 6 laps around the circus, Ben-Hur patiently maintains position behind Messala, studying his techniques while preserving his horse's strength. In the final lap, when Messala believes victory is assured, Ben-Hur unleashes his team's full power. As they battle for position on the final turn, Ben-Hur executes a dangerous maneuver, allowing his lower chariot hub to catch Messala's wheel spokes. The Roman's chariot shatters spectacularly, leaving Messala trampled and crippled for life while Ben-Hur races to victory. Though he has achieved his revenge, Ben-Hur finds it brings little satisfaction. Messala, humiliated and financially ruined by the massive gambling losses, attempts one final act of vengeance by hiring assassins to kill Ben-Hur. When this plot fails, Messala reveals a devastating truth. Ben-Hur's mother and sister were imprisoned in a hidden cell beneath the Antonia Fortress all these years. Now, having contracted leprosy during their confinement, they have been released to die slowly in the Valley of the Lepers outside Jerusalem. Returning to Jerusalem, Ben-Hur's grief and rage intensify as he walks the familiar streets that now feel alien to him. He reclaims his family's ancestral home, once a symbol of prominence and joy, but finds only hollow rooms and dust-covered memories. His solitude is broken by an extraordinary discovery. Faithful Amra, their former servant, has survived all these years in the sealed house, sustaining herself on rainwater and whatever food she could gather, while holding on to hope that the family would one day return. This reunion brings both comfort and renewed determination. Together, Ben-Hur and Amra begin a methodical search through Jerusalem's outskirts for his mother and sister. Their efforts lead them to the Valley of Hinnom, where lepers are banished to live in caves and ruins. In one of the novel's most emotionally devastating scenes, Ben-Hur finally locates his family, but can only watch from a distance as his mother raises her hands in warning, crying out, "Unclean, unclean!" She absolutely refuses to let him approach, her maternal love expressing itself through this cruel necessity of separation. The scene becomes even more heartrending when she extracts a promise from Amra to maintain silence about their condition, preferring that her son remember them as the noble women they once were rather than the afflicted outcasts they've become. This profound tragedy transforms Ben-Hur's existing resentment toward Rome into an all-consuming mission for vengeance. He channels his pain into action, systematically building a network of resistance fighters in the desert. Drawing on his experience in the Roman military, he trains them in advanced combat techniques while gathering intelligence about Roman fortifications and troop movements. Simonides, now a wealthy merchant, becomes his chief strategist and financier, secretly channeling resources to arm and equip the growing force. Sheikh Ilderim, impressed by Ben-Hur's character and sharing his hatred of Rome, provides sanctuary in his territories and contributes his tribe's legendary horsemanship to the cause. Ben-Hur increasingly fixates on ancient prophecies about the Messiah, interpreting them through a lens of military liberation. He envisions himself as the sword of God, ready to serve as general to a divine warrior king who will sweep away Roman oppression and restore Jewish sovereignty. This dream sustains him through months of preparation and planning. The appearance of John the Baptist along the Jordan River sends ripples through Jerusalem. His fierce proclamations about preparing for the kingdom of God align with Ben-Hur's expectations, drawing him to investigate. However, the moment John identifies Jesus of Nazareth as the Son of God triggers an unexpected crisis of faith in Ben-Hur. He recognizes Jesus as the compassionate stranger who offered him water during his darkest hour years ago, a memory that stands in stark contrast to his vision of a conquering Messiah. This gentle figure, with his message of peace and forgiveness, forces Ben-Hur to question everything he has come to believe about justice, revenge, and the true nature of divine deliverance. As Jesus' ministry grows, Ben-Hur witnesses incredible miracles. Water turned to wine, thousands fed with minimal provisions, the blind given sight, lepers cleansed, and even the dead restored to life. Despite possessing such power, Jesus shows no interest in claiming earthly authority or wealth. When Ben-Hur's followers attempt to crown him king, Jesus simply walks away. This confounds Ben-Hur, who cannot reconcile Jesus' supernatural abilities with his apparent disinterest in political revolution. When Amra learns that Jesus heals lepers, she secretly brings Ben-Hur's mother and sister to the road where Jesus will pass. As the crowd shouts, "Blessed is the King," and waves palm branches, Jesus stops before the kneeling women. With simple faith, the mother pleads, "You can make us clean." Jesus responds, "Woman, great is your faith. Be it as you wish." Instantly, their disease vanishes, their bodies restored to health after 8 years of suffering. Ben-Hur, witnessing this miracle from the crowd, joyfully reunites with his family, overcome with gratitude toward the man he once offered water to in his own moment of need. This personal miracle deepens Ben-Hur's devotion to Jesus, though he still struggles to understand the nature of Christ's kingdom. When Jesus is arrested in Gethsemane, Ben-Hur offers to summon his fighters to rescue him, but Jesus' silent look makes clear this is not his path. The next day, as Jesus carries his cross toward Calvary, Ben-Hur discovers that many of his trained soldiers have joined the mob against Christ, convinced by the priests that Jesus must die for blasphemy. At Golgotha, Ben-Hur watches in anguish as Jesus is crucified. The sky darkens, the earth trembles, and with Jesus' final words, "It is finished," Ben-Hur finally understands that Christ's mission was never about earthly power, but spiritual redemption. In this moment, Balthasar, who witnessed both Christ's birth and death, peacefully passes away, his lifelong search complete. 5 years after the crucifixion, we find Ben-Hur settled into a transformed life with his beloved Esther, with whom he has two children, a son and daughter, who represent hope for a new generation raised in Christ's teachings. They have fully embraced the growing Christian movement, converting their palatial home into a gathering place for believers, and using their considerable wealth to support persecuted Christians throughout Jerusalem. Their marriage exemplifies the peace that eluded Ben-Hur during his years of seeking vengeance, showing how love can heal even the deepest wounds. The past resurfaces dramatically when a haggard and dying Iris appears at their door. Once the epitome of Egyptian beauty and cunning, she is now a hollow shadow of her former self. She reveals that she personally killed Messala in Rome, not for Ben-Hur's sake, but out of her own twisted sense of justice and betrayal. The confession comes as both shock and relief, closing a chapter of violence that Ben-Hur had long ago chosen to leave behind. When Esther, embodying the Christian principles she and Ben-Hur now live by, offers Iris shelter and friendship, the Egyptian woman declines with a bitter smile. "I have chosen my path," she declares, "and won't last much longer." A stark contrast to the redemptive journey Ben-Hur has embraced. In his final reflections, Ben-Hur contemplates how far he has come from the angry young man who dreamed of leading Christ's army to earthly victory. His great plan for Jesus as a military Messiah now seems naive and worldly, a reflection of his own desire for revenge rather than true understanding. The revolution Jesus actually brought was far more profound. Not the clash of swords and thunder of chariots, but the quiet transformation of hearts and souls through love and forgiveness. Though his role proved humbler than his youthful ambitions imagined, Ben-Hur finds deep fulfillment in serving this greater purpose. He and Esther dedicate themselves to spreading Christ's message throughout Jerusalem and beyond, using their influence to protect the nascent Christian community. Their home becomes a sanctuary where former enemies pray together, and their lives demonstrate the power of forgiveness to break cycles of violence. Ben-Hur's journey from privileged youth to vengeful warrior to humble disciple completes a profound circle of transformation that mirrors the novel's central theme. True freedom comes not from defeating one's enemies, but from liberating oneself from hatred's chains. Through Ben-Hur's epic journey, we witness how personal tragedy can either consume us with bitterness or open us to profound spiritual growth. His story reminds us that even in our darkest moments, whether enslaved in a Roman galley or burning with thoughts of revenge, unexpected encounters can plant seeds of transformation. These seeds, when nurtured by love and faith, can eventually lead us from the destructive path of vengeance to the higher road of redemption and peace. The genius of Ben-Hur lies in its masterful juxtaposition of two competing visions of power and salvation. The Roman Empire represents worldly might, military conquest, political domination, and material wealth. This is the kingdom Messala embraces, where strength is measured in legions, wealth in gold, and success in territorial expansion. The Romans view power as a zero-sum game. One must dominate or be dominated, conquer or be conquered. This is the world of the Colosseum, of triumph and humiliation, where mercy is weakness and victory demands blood. In stark contrast, Jesus offers an alternative kingdom that turns these Roman values upside down. His is a realm based on spiritual transformation, forgiveness, and self-sacrifice, values that seem not merely foolish but dangerously naive by Roman standards. Yet these principles prove more enduring than marble monuments or military victories. While Rome's power depends on external force, Christ's influence works from within, changing hearts rather than territories. Throughout the narrative, Ben-Hur stands at the crossroads between these kingdoms, embodying humanity's eternal struggle between vengeance and forgiveness. His journey from privileged Jewish prince to galley slave to champion charioteer traces an arc of transformation that goes beyond mere physical survival or social redemption. When he finally witnesses Christ's crucifixion, Ben-Hur confronts the ultimate paradox. True victory often comes through apparent defeat, and real power can manifest in willing powerlessness. The novel's enduring appeal stems from this universal struggle between our instinct for retributive justice and the challenging path of restorative love. Ben-Hur's personal vendetta against Masala mirrors countless human conflicts, from family feuds to international wars, where the cycle of revenge perpetuates suffering. His eventual transformation offers hope that even after betrayal, imprisonment, and loss, healing is possible through a radical reorientation of the heart. In Ben-Hur's journey, we see reflected our own struggles with power, justice, and meaning. His story reminds us that while empires rise and fall by the sword, the most profound revolutions happen in the human heart. The chariots of war may write history's headlines, but it's the quiet acts of forgiveness that truly change the world. This dual vision of worldly power versus spiritual transformation continues to resonate because it speaks to humanity's deepest questions about justice, purpose, and the true nature of victory.